Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we have a geophysicist with us. Her name is Anne Sheehan. She's a professor of geology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, a great place to be a geologist. And we're going to be talking about her research, which is sort of involving what happens underneath Mount Everest. And you might say, well, why would you need to know? Well, it has implications for the future, and the past helps us understand the future, and so that's what we're going to be talking about. So, Anne, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I hope so. Before we get into geology, let's talk a little bit about Anne Sheehan. It's a lovely Irish name, at least it seems to me it is. How did you get into science and then into geology?
I grew up in Kansas, in Topeka, Kansas. And
a lot of mountains in Topeka.
No, Kansas. No mountains. That was part of the attraction of mountains. It was fun to go to mountains. And always wondered how they got there. And I certainly liked rocks and collecting fossils. In Kansas, there are a lot of pretty much flat rocks. I knew the rock section pretty well. And lots of fossils, so all these sedimentary rocks. So as a kid, I was interested in math and science, and actually had an uncle who was a geologist, and I met a geophysicist at a high school science lecture, and that was kind of what got me into geology and geophysics.
There aren't too many high school students today that would sort of throw around the word geophysicist quite as nicely. I mean, people know geologists and physicists. It's this interdisciplinary area that's becoming more and more important that people don't know much about.
Right. And that was really attractive to me, actually, because I like math. And with geophysics, you are applying math and physics to geology problems.
Did you enjoy just rambling around out there looking at the geology? Or was it more mathematical? You prefer to be in a laboratory or you prefer to be out there kicking rocks?
It's a combination. Actually, when I was an undergrad, I did a lot of summers out in the field, really long, hard work. And then after those summers, it was kind of nice to be in an air-conditioned office working on a computer. So
right.
I liked the mix.
Do you remember what that geophysicist talked about?
He talked about earthquakes in Kansas, which there aren't very many. But at that point, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was putting in new nuclear power plants at different parts of the country, and so they wanted to know what the earthquake hazards were in different places. So they were funding little earthquake networks in various places. So there was one in northeast Kansas, and I thought that was really interesting that there were little earthquakes and how you could identify them.
Have you ever actually been in an earthquake of some magnitude?
I have felt some small earthquakes. I've never been in a big earthquake.
I was in one in Japan. I just knew I landed up on the floor, and I hadn't realized what was going on. I just thought it was workmen, you know, on the road outside. And I don't know what the magnitude was, but big enough to throw me out of bed.
Oh, wow.
That was exciting.
Wow.
Especially when you're not expecting it.
Right.
Now
I
go there. I get a little worried, paranoid.
But I did a sabbatical in New Zealand, and there are a lot of earthquakes there, and we lived right on an earthquake fault. So it was a big hill. It had a beautiful view of the bay, but it was an earthquake scarp, so we were pretty nervous about it. And there was one time when my daughters were really small, and one of them jumped on the couch, and the whole house shook. I scolded her for jumping on the couch, but we were both kind of looking very puzzled at each other.
That's a big impact for a little girl.
Yeah, and it was an earthquake, and I found out later. And she
Is this
still
in
remembers.
South Island or North Island?
That was in Wellington,
oh,
on
lovely.
The North Island.
Right. No, Wellington's a lovely place.
It is.
And now it's become quite famous for wine, white wine.
Oh, right.
Sauvignon
right.
Blanc. I mean, you get it all over the place, and it's nice.
Right.
Okay, so where did you go to school? You know, when you grew up in Kansas, did you go to Kansas?
Yeah, I went to University of Kansas in Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working for Don Steeples, who was the geophysicist who gave that high school lecture that I went to.
Oh, how amazing. I mean, was that sort of a plan? It wasn't quite serendipity.
Right. He gave this lecture, and I met him, and I visited his lab and got a job
now,
as a
Were you a senior
assistant.
In high school at that stage?
Yes.
Because, you know, we don't give, as scientists in general, there's not a lot of scientists that I know who go to high schools to give talks. And I think that should perhaps be more expected and implicitly understood for faculty in science?
Yeah, it was an important time for me as a senior in high school, kind of deciding what I wanted to do. And my parents were convinced that it would not be possible to have a career in science. That was not useful enough. And so it was good for me to see, look, here's somebody who has a job. They're not unemployed.
Right.
And they're doing interesting work.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
And did they
Irish,
all go?
I mean, I have 10 brothers and sisters.
Okay. So now they all went out and did what you might call useful work, or did they land up as academics?
Yeah. Nurses and teachers and business people. Mm-hmm. And then I'm towards the end. So the ones at the beginning were much more traditional.
Right.
The ones towards the end, my parents kind of
It seems to be working okay.
Yeah. And they didn't have all the curfews and rules. So we didn't have much to rebel against. So we were very good, very boring. And so my sister that's closest to me in age is an oncologist. So
that's kind useful work.
Yeah, that's very useful work. But it's kind of non-traditional for a Irish Catholic girl from the Midwest.
All right.
And my younger brother works in kind of nutrition and chemistry.
Okay. Before we get into the geology, which is what all the audience is waiting with bated breath to listen to, tell me a little bit about, have you followed the tradition of your mentor? Do you go back to high schools and give presentations and talks at that level?
Yeah, I've given more talks to middle schools because it seems like middle school is a good age when kids are excited about science and they're not too cool.
And that's
for
that,
it
that's
yet.
Part of a sort of a program in Colorado?
No, that's been
you.
It's a mix. Yeah, I've given talks just as a volunteer, and then actually at the University of Colorado we have something called the Science Discovery Program, and they have workshops that are themed, and every year there's a different theme, and then they go around to middle schools all over the state of Colorado and have a one-day science workshop. And so
there's a group of you go and do this.
Right. So it's every year it's a different theme. So one year, 2 years ago, it was hazards, and I helped them build the workshop.
So mainly middle school workshops. So I like that idea. We do, you know, the usual, the physics circus and the science and the chemistry circus and bangs and explosions, but the theme idea, I think, because you can put many things together.
Right. And this last year, the theme was renewable energy, and it's very hands-on. So they built a little solar panel-powered car, and they learned about geothermal.
So it's a combination of science and engineering, which goes out there, probably.
Yeah. And it is very hands-on. And the thing is, if it was just here, say if you did something just in El Paso, you don't reach all the small communities.
No. Okay, so the geology. You're a professor of geology and you specialize in geophysics. So explain to the audience just a little bit the nature of your interest in geophysics.
Okay. Geophysics is using principles of physics to study the Earth. So the geo is Earth and physics is things like math, gravity, wave propagation, magnetics. And a lot of the Earth is, we can't see it directly. It's beneath us. The deepest drill hole is 12 kilometers, but the radius of the Earth is 6,400 kilometers. So there's just an awful lot of the Earth that we have not touched. But with geophysics, we can see into the Earth. And so I'm very interested in that. I do a lot with seismology, and we can send waves into the Earth. Earthquakes send waves into the Earth, and we can get a picture of the subsurface. Like a CAT scan in medicine.
You would drill holes down to certain depths with an explosive, set it off, and then watch the sound waves propagate through the different waves.
Yeah, we can do that. Right. Actually, I do more with earthquakes. Okay. Those are cheaper because they happen all the time setting them off.
That's right. Talk about that a little because, I mean, we read on the news mainly in El Paso and in this region of earthquakes. They're always muy lejos. They're always somewhere else, a long way away. But we have a lot here, as you did in Kansas. Explain that to the audience.
Okay. Well, yeah, earthquakes happen all over the place. They tend to happen along plate boundaries, along the Ring of Fire. There really aren't that many right around here. There are some related to the Rio Grande Rift, Some are human-induced from things like pumping waste into the ground, fluid.
That's a common – yes. Talk about that a little because most people don't know about this.
So in Colorado, there's kind of a famous set of induced earthquakes near Denver at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. In the 1960s, they were pumping a lot of waste fluid into the ground.
Full of plutonium and uranium.
No, not the bad one. That's Rocky Flats. Okay. At Rocky Mountain Arsenal, it was bad stuff, but right. It was more chemical. And there were a lot of earthquakes that were induced by this. And some of them were, you know, magnitude 5. So they caused a lot of shaking.
That is understood. It wasn't at the time, perhaps.
Right, right.
With explosives, you could imagine putting up a small nuclear device on the San Andreas Fault might do something. But just pumping water into the ground, that's quite remarkable.
Yeah, so that changes what's called the pore fluid pressure, and when you can change it so that faulting can happen.
And now magnitude 5. Now, that's crockery falls off of the cupboards, does it not? At magnitude 5?
Yeah, magnitude 5, you could get cracks in the wall. Things could fall down.
I remember one earthquake, the nasty one in Mexico City 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. We saw that up here in the sense that I didn't myself, but one of my colleagues has a swimming pool. And that morning he said the water in his swimming pool was – and he was thinking, God, what did I drink last night or something,
wow.
you know?
Wow.
And then later on came the news. So, I mean, they – propagation – goes a long way.
Right, right.
So when you have an earthquake in, let's say, British Columbia, mm-hmm. we can monitor it in Kansas or Colorado
right,
or here.
Right, right.
So when you say you use these shock waves from earthquakes, how do you go about doing that if they're happening all the time and you're getting multiple signals?
Okay. Well, for example, 2 days ago there was an earthquake in Java. It's magnitude 7. And I could go online and download seismograms from different stations, and I looked at
worldwide stations,
and so I looked at a station that was very close to here in the Cornudos Mountains, and it recorded that earthquake beautifully. So an earthquake all the way from northwest of Australia, and so the U.S.
So in fact, I mean, that rings up because that's halfway around the world,
right?
So if you're somewhere in between, you're going to get it twice. You're going to get it, the direct propagation, and then the propagation all the way around.
Right, right.
Does that lead to interesting new observations and information?
Sure, yeah. You can use that to study the Earth's structure using that. So sometimes, like a big enough earthquake, like the Sumatra tsunami earthquake in 2004, you could see it going back and forth 9 or 10 times around
the
world.
Spanning the globe
just going
that many
around
times,
and around.
And slowly weaker and weaker each time.
Right,
we'll come back and discuss that. You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Ann Sheehan from the University of Colorado, and we'll be back shortly.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you're a loyal listener, you know I've written several episodes on Egyptian pharaohs.
Another one of your Dr. Death episodes?
Yep, but this time it's not about King Tut, but Ramses III, who ruled Egypt in its 20th dynasty between 1186 and 1155 BCE.
Ramses defended Egypt from 3 foreign invasions and developed industry and trade with Africa's Somali coast. The middle of his reign was prosperous, but later, corruption and instability undermined his reign.
That's when his second wife, Queen Tai, plotted to overthrow Ramses and install her son Pentuer as pharaoh. But ancient papyri document their failed coup and then trial. What they did not reveal is whether the conspirators killed Ramses before getting caught.
Ancient records show Ramses died that same year, but not how he died. Well, we no longer have to guess. Scientists recently managed to run CT scans on the pharaoh and a man buried with him suspected of being Pentuer.
The scan revealed Ramses' throat had been slit deeply and probably killed him immediately. Inside the wound, they found a Horus Eye amulet, a metaphor of royal power and protection, which embalmers likely inserted to promote healing in the afterworld.
By contrast, the second mummy, an 18 to 20-year-old man, was embalmed improperly and covered with a ritually impure goat skin, which scientists interpreted as punishment in the afterlife. His neck also bore evidence he may have been strangled. Finally, DNA analysis of the Y chromosomes of the mummy and Ramses revealed that they were likely father and son.
Another of history's mysteries solved. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back. This is Keith Pannell and Sheehan, Professor of Geology, talking about, in this moment anyway, earthquakes. And when an earthquake happens halfway around the world, it propagates in all directions, and you can watch this propagation go around and around the globe many times. So, Anne, what do you learn from that? What's the bottom line?
Okay. Well, from studying the earthquakes, we can get a better picture of what the Earth is made of, the structure of the Earth. We can better understand plate tectonics, what creates mountains, what's underneath them. So some of my work has been on the Rocky Mountains. And when I started my career, we didn't really know how the Rockies got there and what was underneath them. And
really?
And now we have a pretty good
but
idea.
You're a young lady. I mean, I would have thought this was well established a long time ago.
Well, a lot of the technology with having a lot of portable seismic recording equipment has only been around for about 15 years. It used to be that the instruments were much larger and they had to be in temperature-controlled vaults and mines. And now we can put 20 of them in the back of a pickup truck and go all over the place.
So in just a few minutes then, tell us, what was the understanding of the formation of the Rockies 20 years ago, and what is so dramatically different today?
Well, we weren't really sure what caused the Rockies. I think it's still an open question, but we have some better ideas now. And if you went to a national park headquarters, you would see a map that had like a big red arrow from below, pushing the mountains up from below. And now we think that, there could be something going on from below, but it's more horizontal and it's more plate motions from the sides. So on the west, at the Pacific, things are pushing towards the mid-continent. And on the east, the mid-Atlantic is opening. And so you're pushing across that way. And so the Rockies are in the middle. There were some pre-existing weaknesses from old faults. And the uplift seems to be concentrated there. But mostly horizontal, a kind of low angle rather than just pushing up from below.
So if you go the east-west motion, mm-hmm. which is the predominant, which is the most stationary of the two, or are they both moving together?
The west is moving a lot faster than the east is pretty slowly moving.
And so that's a recent discovery.
I guess that's been since actually about the 60s or 70s, since plate tectonics came around. And then the pictures of the subsurface are more recent in the last 10 or 15 years. And so now we can see under the Rockies there is it's seismically slow. So there's something that's low seismic wave speed, some kind of rock that's slowing things down. And usually that's temperature can do that if it's hot. It could be a different kind of rock down there.
Could it be petroleum, just this vast sea of natural
I guess that would
gas.
Slow things down, but, I'm talking about 100 kilometers down, so
Right. Probably
not. But what I think is happening is that the Rio Grande Rift, which is a feature that's right here in El Paso, and the continent now is kind of spreading apart, and that it is moving north into Colorado. So we can see these low velocities.
So hang on a minute. The Rio Grande Rift,
mm-hmm.
okay, up and down north-south rift,
right?
Right. And the Rift Valley is where sort of a big chunk drops down, right? But you say that
things are pulling apart.
Right. So
yeah.
To the west and to the east,
right.
there's movement in opposite directions.
That's right. Right. So the Rockies were formed.
Well, hang on, though, because if you go to the east,
uh-huh.
all right, of the Rio Grande Rift, and something's going east.
Okay.
And then when you get up to the Rockies, there's a piece up there on the east that's going west. Is this a swivel movement? I mean, you were talking about the Rockies being formed by two forces. Now, is this a separate little plate down here?
Well, they were formed 65 million years ago.
That's
and that's kind of done. They're not pushing up anymore. And now what we're seeing is that they're kind of falling apart.
Oh, the Rocky Mountains, they're going down.
Well, We have GPS out there now, and no one knows for sure, but we should know in a few years.
Well, we did recently a program with a geologist. I can't remember the name, but it was all about Everest, and you know, there's simply a natural height that any mountain can get to before it gets so heavy it begins to sink down, regardless of whether there's movement on either sides. I know you've done work in Nepal, so what was your what were you doing over there? Instead of being in the Rockies where you're supposed to be, but University of Colorado, you had a junket.
Right. Well, in Nepal, there's a lot more action in terms of things moving, in terms of big earthquakes. And it was related to things we're doing here with GPS and seismology, and we're just applying it in Nepal and Tibet and looking at the Himalaya and how they formed. And so there had been some GPS work done. And with GPS, you can actually see how the Earth is moving. You know, you use GPS in your car or to navigate. But you can also, if you have a GPS sensor in a certain spot and you record very carefully and you go back a year later and you look again, you can see that the Earth has moved. And so using that, we can see that India is pushing into Eurasia, which had been determined based on geology in the 1960s. And now we can see it happening in real time, in today.
Tell us, what is this, 1 centimeter per decade?
Yeah, it's 40 centimeters a year.
40 centimeters a year?
No, that's not right. 40 millimeters a year. So that's...
For the audience that can't see Anne, she's trying to now work it out with her fourth finger and thumb.
So it's about the speed that your fingernails grow. So you can watch, and they're not really doing much. But if you if you don't do anything for a year, you'll notice something. And that's about how the plates are moving,
about that speed. These Indian gurus who get their fingernails never stop growing.
Yeah. So you could, given that rate, you can calculate how many years it's been since they've clipped their fingernails.
Tell me, the GPS, this is obviously it's satellite technology, right? Is there just one satellite up there that you use, or are there a whole host
of these? No, there's a whole bunch. There's, I don't know, 24 or so.
Okay, so log on to whichever one you choose, or how does that
work? No, you have a GPS receiver. It's the same sort of thing that in your car. It will listen to whichever ones are up there, and you need at least three to get a location. It triangulates.
Right. And it's random then? They're all sort of hooked into one big system that allows this.
Right.
It's not like you pay roaming charges.
Right. I mean, somebody keeps track of what their orbits are, and you have to use that information as well.
Having used your GPS data and you now can see the Indian subcontinent moving up, okay, now we knew it, but now you've quantified it. So what?
So now you can look at how many earthquakes they've had, and you can see how much slip, how much you expect things to move per year. So you can see the kind of what the background level is. And you can also see places where the faults are locked and it's not moving. And it just lurches all at once. So it does 100 years worth of this
pressure buildup.
Four centimeters a year.
It doesn't matter. We've got it.
it does 100 years worth of that
in
an instant. So some places it's creeping slowly, and in some places it's locked and loaded.
Could you be outgoing enough to say that your data, as you accumulate this, you're going to be able to predict not exactly when earthquakes are going to take place, but you're getting a much better idea of the location where this pressure is building up. I mean, that's good news.
At least. It's good news and bad news because, I mean, we can't...
What do you tell people?
Yeah, we can't stop the plates from moving. They are bound to have big earthquakes. And so, you know, there was a big earthquake in China last year, big earthquake in Pakistan in 2005. It can help people know what to expect, but it's not going to stop the earthquakes. And then with the seismology, we can look at the subsurface. We can see what the geometry of the faults is, are, and then you can, combining that with the GPS, you can make a model that says if there is an earthquake, how would it rupture and where would the maximum shaking be?
So, I mean, in theory, I get the idea that if you have enough of these senses all over the place, you get a much more clear pre-indication of an earthquake, because you can find, you know, just before an earthquake, you say it happens just like that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, maybe a day before, 2 days, a week before, you begin to see patterns before all the major earthquakes, or is it really just instantaneous?
That's still an area of research.
Okay.
So we don't know of convincing precursors to earthquakes. I mean, that's certainly a goal of seismology, mm-hmm. is to try to find those things, but we haven't found something that's really convincing.
I remember reading that the Chinese used to watch the way animals behaved. I don't know how successful they were, but they claimed that, you know, by watching carefully animal behavior. Now, maybe this is only hours before. So there are techniques where we don't have them,
right,
to at least give some warning.
Yeah, that hasn't been very convincing. I mean, okay, if anybody has, say, a cat, in any given week, your cat probably acts weird and bizarre.
Okay. Right. All right. Okay, you do a lot of this work up in Nepal and Tibet. Now, recently, I mean, there's a lot of interest in Nepal. I mean, it was one of these places where I think, was it the king, tried to sort of abdicate. He said, look, we've got to become more democratic. And there's a Maoist movement up there. What's it like to do work in that environment?
Well, when I was doing work there, I started working there in 2001, which is right when the royal family was massacred. They were all killed, allegedly, by the crown prince. And so the new king came into power and was not very popular. And there was a Maoist uprising going on, and that ramped up while we were there. So we went in 2001, in September of 2001, so right after 9/11. So flights were being canceled, people were afraid to travel, and we went to Nepal to start our work. Right then, those few weeks were a good time for Americans to travel because there was a lot of global sympathy towards Americans for a few weeks. And we put our seismic stations in all over eastern Nepal. We flew to places and hiked and drove. But there was a lot of unrest in the countryside. You could just kind of feel it. And one of our sites was near an airport tower at a beautiful village called Paflu, high in the mountains. And shortly after we returned in November of 2001, I was reading NepalNews.com, which gives you news about what's going on at Nepal. And there was news about a Maoist incident in Paflu, which is where we had just put the seismometer. And they blew up the airport tower, which was 30 meters away from where we had a seismometer.
So you could very precisely monitor that.
So we recorded that. And the Maoists and the army actually left our seismic station alone. It had a little tiny little fence around it, and they had other things to worry about. But what had been a really beautiful village that we went there before, we spent extra time at, was the place that now we were just in and out of there as quickly as we could get.
Well, you know, we've run out of time. We work on a different time scale
okay.
of geologists.
Okay.
All right. But we've done our 30 minutes or whatever it is. Anne Sheehan, University of Colorado, professor of geology, geophysics, earthquake specialist. Thank you so much for being here.
All right. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks, Norma Martinez, for the beautiful smile at the other end of the studio. And to you for listening, and we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Manuel de la Rosa, founding dean of the Paul Foster School of Medicine, recently received the title of Hispanic Physician of the Year. The National Hispanic Medical Association presents the honor annually to a doctor who has played a significant leadership role in the health of Hispanics. The association represents more than 40,000 U.S. Hispanic physicians. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.